Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the EDH Retcast, where we're all about Commander, data, and dad jokes. I'm Joey Schultz and I'm joined by my fantastic co-hosts. Up first, he really wants to play good ol' Felix Five Boots, and to equip him with five pairs of boots, it's Matt Morgan.
So Outlaws of Thunder Junction is now released, so I've got a desert-related pun for you. Joey, you know what the best-selling car on Arrakis is?
I don't.
It's a Nissan Al-Ghaib. It's fun though, because actually the most popular haircut for Harkonnens is actually a fade.
Matt, I'm sorry, I'm about to embarrass myself real hardcore in front of the audience. What is Arrakis? What is Harkonnen?
My gosh, it's Dune. It's only like the best movie in the past.
Oh, it's Dune. Oh, no, I really like Dune. I still need to see the sequel. I haven't seen the sequel yet. I'm sorry, okay? Maybe I will by the time this episode comes out. Don't yell at me, internet. I'm sorry. Oh no, Matt,
I've never been so disappointed with you. Never.
That's the true evolution. Is just, you've gone from like dad jokes to dad just disappointment.
Dad like disappointment. I had one more joke, but yeah, I don't even want to tell it anymore because it's gonna be, actually no, Dana will appreciate it. What do you call a sandworm that never breaches the surface? It's a shy halude.
All I know is that there's a card named Sandworm Convergence in Magic. Anyway, let's actually officially introduce our other co-host and move on from my embarrassment. Up next, he's surprised that the set named Big Score doesn't include the card Big Score. It's Dana Roach. Dana, don't make fun of me.
I won't, because I'm a little jumpy this morning. I was in my office and a janitor like leaped out of the broom closet and scared the heck out of me. The last thing you're ready for first thing in the morning is someone popping out and yelling supplies. So he caught me off guard for sure.
See, now Matt, that's a dad joke I can understand.
We could just sweep that one under the rug. It wasn't great.
Listen, I'm just glad that I got this one.
we're opting for clean jokes though, which is nice.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Oh no, I'm never going to live this down. I'm really afraid of the internet's response to this, actually. So anyway.
I think we need to get going, actually. I'm going to go look at a car. It's a Kwisatz hatchback. So
I'm really so flummoxed. I wish I got these. I wish I understood. I'm sorry. All right.
I think Matt has a whole list of like weird Dune car puns now.
This actually, this came up in a real conversation. My friend and I were like just cranking them out. It was a lot of fun.
I'm gonna go watch Dune 2 and I'm gonna be like, so I'm like, oh, I get it finally. Oh, that's so funny. Like, it's finally gonna hit me. I'm gonna have a very delayed reaction to your jokes, Matt. What are we talking about on this episode though? I'm trying so hard to save face.
Well, so we're going to talk about like our impressions of the cards that we've seen in 2024. Joey has no impressions of films from 2024 because they haven't even seen half of them. But the cards Magic the Gathering has produced for us to play with, we're going to talk about those and some of our highlights of Outlaws Thunder Junction, the Fallout cards. Karlov Manor also came out. There's a lot of options.
Yeah. Some highlights, some cards that have really stuck out to us that are impressing us. But also, like, what is our impression of the year so far? How are we feeling about the EDH offerings in 2024? So nice holistic view of like what's been happening so far. Let's get acclimated. Let's see how this year is actually stacking up for Commander. But real quick, before we get into it, we've got some shout outs to do. First and foremost, Chase, aka Mana Curves. Chase, it's so much fun working with you on the episodes and editing all of the stuff. So thank you so much, Mana Curves.
We're also now proud members of Team Ultimate Guard. It's very easy to recommend a product you actually use, and we use their products. If you happen to play some games with Matt and I at Command Fest San Francisco here recently, you got to see us with our katana sleeves on our decks and them ensconced safely inside Boulder deck boxes. We can't recommend them highly enough, which is why we use nothing but Ultimate Guard on our decks.
Can I just really quick shout out Dana's use of the word ensconced. What a lovely word. What a great word. A great word for a great epic combination, a great product.
Yeah, you can't say anything else was ensconced unless it's in Ultima Guard products. It's just how it works.
There we go.
Well, if you would like to support the show, you can do so in a lot of different ways. You can subscribe on YouTube. You can like this video. You can share this video. Just word of mouth advertising, it actually helps content creators so much by recommending us to your friends. That it means the world. It's just an easy and free way to support the show and just any content creator that you love. But if you are so moved and you would like to buy Joey a movie ticket to go see Dune 2 in theaters or rent it on Amazon, you can go to patreon.com/edhreccast, where we have patron tiers of all sorts of levels, or you want to join our Discord community, which is actually just pretty great. There's a TV and film channel that you can talk about having seen Dune 2 in movie theaters and make Joey have FOMO about it. You can do that in our patron Discord, along with there's other tiers. You can see all of our episodes a day early. There's all sorts of fun things going on over at patreon.com/edhreccast, including the weekly patron shout out, which goes to Samuel Neville, who I'm Neville gonna say his name wrong because it's pretty easy to remember. Sam, thanks for buying Joey that movie ticket to go see Dune 2, which he totally did or will be doing soon.
You know, Matt, if we get enough support, maybe I can even get the popcorn bucket. I hear that for Dune, that's a very famous or infamous popcorn bucket, actually.
It's a popcorn bucket. It's one of the popcorn buckets of all time.
That's taking this show in a direction I don't think anyone wants to take it into.
That's a good point. Point being, thank you so much, Samuel, for your support.
Yes.
Listeners, I promise I'm going to see this movie. Oh, no. I didn't realize. The last time I saw Matt react to somebody like this is when he saw someone who didn't have their cards double-sleeved. He was just like, wait, what? You haven't? What? What's going on?
Honestly, though, I wasn't wrong either time.
I don't double-sleeve all my decks.
And you don't treat your decks properly. Why would you not use inner sleeves made by Ultima Guard, the best deck building accessories out there?
I actually do. They're fantastic. They fit really, really well.
So snug and perfect.
I'm trying to focus. I'm just seeing how many times I can rile Matt up with the things I have not done this episode. But let's actually get to our topic now. The impressions that we have of 2024 so far. How's it stacking up and what cards are standing out to us? And maybe we'll go in like reverse chronological order. I can pronounce words. Reverse chronological order here. Like starting with the most recent stuff, Thunder Junction. Like Dana, what's standing out to you from that set? How do you feel about its impact on EDH and which cards are you most excited about?
Of the sets we've got this year, I think has the most things I at least want to try. You know, this is brand new, so some things may not necessarily work out. I think the card I'm probably most hyped to try out is Fomori Vault, and that is a land that's it's in technically the Thunder Junction. Big Score, which is kind of, I think it was supposed to be like a separate set that they baked into the main set, so it's like an additional sheet, so you get these as like a bonus card. It's a land, comes into play untapped, which is a big deal. Taps for colorless mana, and you can spend 3 and tap it to discard a card and look at the top X cards of your library, where X is the number of artifacts you control, and you put one of those cards into your hand and the rest in the bottom of your library in a random order. You know, not every deck is probably going to want this, although the amount of decks that have, you know, no artifacts is pretty low. But there's a lot of decks where this is going to draw you, like, you're going to be digging down 10, 12, like 15 cards in some cases in equipment decks or decks with lots of treasure or clues or food or artifact creatures, whatever. There's just a lot of decks where like this is going to be basically a 4-mana repeatable kind of tutor effect that you can use on a land whenever you want to with little or no opportunity cost. You have to discard a card to it, which, you know, is not a downside in some decks either. So this card, I think, has a lot of potential to be something very spicy in a lot of lists.
I like it in colorless decks, too. If you've got, like, a Kozilek as your commander or something like that, this strikes me as a really good piece to, like, make sure that you're still finding the stuff you need.
And the other lands that I'm really interested in seeing how they play out here are the Desert Duel lands. They're you know, nothing amazing, and I probably wouldn't be looking at them twice, except for the fact that I have Scavenger Grounds in every single deck, and these give me one more land to use to sacrifice Scavenger Grounds. I heard you clear your throat, Joey. I understand there are plenty of reasons to not run Scavenger Grounds. I mean, some people don't like to win. some people enjoy losing.
Wow.
but aside from those reasons, I feel like you probably want to consider Scavenger Grounds in most decks. And this gives me like a second activation, a second way to use it while sacrificing itself. I don't entirely know if that's going to be worth running an ETB tapped land yet, but I'm going to try them for sure. I think it might be. So I'm going to experiment with these as well to see if it's worth having them there just for that purpose.
That's, yeah, I actually like, you know, of the lands that are here, I also want to shout out a desert, which I prefer more than the stuff that you're planning on doing. This is a desert I don't want to sacrifice to Scavenger Grounds. Also, leave my graveyard alone, Dana. But like, there's a new version of Guildless Commons in the set, and that's Arid Archway. Mm-hmm. And it's got like desert text, and that's cute, but it doesn't matter. It's just another Guildless Commons, and Guildless Commons is showing up in 52,000 decks. And y'all know I really like bounce lands because they can actually help me discard to hand size and fill my graveyard. But like, I don't know. It was just, I was excited to see another one of those, like small little subtle things happening in the land base. That's cool to see. So even though I don't like the reasons that you pick those deserts, I understand what you're getting at. Like those small things in a land base can actually, they can add up over time with enough of them.
I mean, I think that this card, just especially the big score set, has so many just like our friends over at One More Mana would describe it as bruh cards. Like you look at them and you can't say anything else. You're just like taken aback by it. Vaultborn Tyrant. 5 mana, green, 6/6 with trample. Whenever Vaultborn Tyrant or another creature with power 4 or greater enters the battlefield under your control, gain 3 life and draw a card. That's enough to be a really good card. that's more than enough, but it has more abilities. When Vaultborn Tyrant dies, if it's not a token, create a copy of, or create a token that's a copy of it, except it's an artifact in addition to its other types. Bruh, what were they thinking with this card? Like you have to kill it twice,
and it draws two cards.
Such a, and it draws two cards. It is, this is such a problem. Just I had a conversation with some people on social media a while back about like how power creep, and Dana, you and I talked about on the show, power creep isn't going 1-2-3 anymore. Power creep is going 1-3-5, and Vaultborn Tyrant is the 7 in that 1-3-5. This card is preposterous. And then Nexus of Becoming, also, if you have any sort of ETB abilities, Nexus of Becoming is another way just to get some of your best ETBs and just draw cards into them.
Yeah, 6 mana artifact at the beginning of combat on your turn, you draw a card, then you may exile an artifact or creature card from your hand. If you do, create a token that's a copy of the exiled card, except it is a 3/3 golem artifact in addition to its other types. So just cool. Just get your stuff. It'll be a 3/3, but like we all know that you're going to be able to do a whole lot of stuff with those tokens. And yeah, this is a neat way of like giving yourself card advantage, but also like you can cheat certain things into play, which Matt, I don't want to see what you're going to do with either of these mythic cards, because I know I'm going to die quickly when you do.
Like I think big score, just the fact that it was a supplemental set, I hate saying we don't want cards, but like it felt so unnecessary because Thunder Junction already was a very, very powerful set. I think Molten Duplication only being 2 mana to just get a copy of whatever your best thing is, even for a turn, is pretty ludicrously powerful. Like this whole set, like I know, Dana, you really like Fomori Vault. You could just name a card from this, the big score, and I would just believe you that it's going to be an incredibly popular card.
Yeah, there's just, it's like an extra copy of all the, or an extra version of mythics almost. Like, what if instead of a set had, you know, 10 good mythics, it had 20, and we're just going to make an extra add-on slot just for those. This is just a loaded series of cards, and there's a lot of things I'm really, really curious to see how they play out in Impact decks for sure.
Well, it's kind of funny, like y'all are here on those big mythics, but like some of the stuff that's caught my eye aren't even like the mythics. It's actually some of the stuff that's like at uncommon. Like there's a new copy of Felstinger, for example. It's like Unscrupulous something. It's some type of rogue or mercenary guy that you can sacrifice a creature to draw two cards. I'm like, all right, sweet. But the stuff that's really caught my eye are actually like spree cards, such as Return the Favor, which is basically a new version of Wild Ricochet that you can actually like modulate the cost on. So you can use this red spell, it's an instant, to just copy someone else's instant or sorcery spell, or their activated ability or triggered ability. So like, okay, that's crazy, and choose new targets for the copy. Or you can like add on an additional mana to also change the target of the spell or ability that you're copying. So it's a new and improved Wild Ricochet, which is itself showing up in 24,000 decks. And I love Wild Ricochet. That's one of my preferred like red cards. I really like that one. So to see more stuff like this and other spree cards as well, Dana, I know you're a fan of a couple of them too. Mm-hmm. Just like some of these uncommons are like, ooh, that's catching my eye. These are neat.
I mean, some of the commons even make me say, holy cow.
Wow.
Because that's a card in the set. And it is a common.
Yeah, I mean, there's stuff like Great Train Heist. I it never occurred to me that we needed a better Relentless Assault. But we got one. You know, being able to do that at instant speed probably isn't that huge of an advantage, but it's not nothing. And then you can also, you know, tack on a creature buff and first strike, and you can tack on a way to make a bunch of treasures. That's just ridiculous. Like, instant speed Relentless Assault alone would be pretty impressive. The fact that you have the option to order, you know, fries as a side and a dessert with it as well for the same price is something for sure.
And Relentless Assault shows up in 62,000 decks. So mm-hmm. to have another one that is like just at baseline, you can have it as a 4-mana, another Relentless Assault, but it also could give you other benefits if you need. Yeah, that's impressive.
The other spree card, and spree is just kind of the new version of Kicker, more or less, where you can choose whatever modes you want, although the base version of this doesn't do anything, I guess, will be the difference. Smuggler's Surprise is a really, really decent card too. Heroic Intervention with add-ons, although it only gives the Hexproof and Indestructible to creatures you control with power 4 or greater, but that's at the same base cost as Heroic Intervention, one in a green, and then you can also, for 2 more mana, make someone mill 4 cards and put 2 creature or land cards from among them into your hand, or you can add on 4 in a green and put up to 2 creature cards from your hand onto the battlefield. Just kind of does anything you'd want to be doing in a green deck, and if you want to pump that much mana into it, you have the ability basically to turn someone else's board wipe into not a board wipe for you while simultaneously putting creature cards into play and making things worse. That's pretty impressive for a card that can also just be used for 2 mana to save your stuff. There's just a lot of flexibility in this, and yeah, it's probably not that good in an elf deck or something, but if you're playing dinosaurs with any of the new, you know, crazy busted ones we seem to get every single set, then hey, that's a really, really powerful card.
Yeah, that card is just custom tailor-made for my Vavitkus Asmati deck because
yeah, I was just gonna
it's
say.
All about cheating big creatures into play and then mm-hmm. also protecting them.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, it has that power 4 greater clause, but this protects anything Matt cares about.
Right, yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. Pretty much.
Well, and I also enjoy, like, you know, again, I'm really focusing on, like, some of the uncommons here. Those are the things that have stuck out to me. But, like, cards that are secretly modal, mm-hmm. you know, the spree cards are very obviously modal, choose this mode. And they are, like, you know, those required costs. You do have to, like, pay those extra things. But, like, there's a lot of flexibility with those. But I enjoy even, like, the simple stuff, like Fleeting Reflection, I think is going to be slept on a lot from this set. That's the blue instant for 2 mana. And target creature you control gains Hexproof until end of turn. Untap that creature. Until end of turn, it becomes a copy of up to one other target creature. Even if it just did one of those things, it'd be like, ooh, okay, a temporary Hexproof. That's nice. Sometimes I just need to spend one card to step dodge an opponent's removal spell. It also untaps it. Ooh, surprise blocker. I can also become a copy of the best thing on the field for a turn. Like, even if it did only like 2 of those things, I'd still be impressed. It does all 3. And I'm kind of like, there's a lot of uses where that could be really neat. Yeah, stuff like that is really standing out to me. I also, though, there's a new removal spell here, Shoot the Sheriff, which can destroy any creature that isn't an outlaw. And Dana, I believe you've got some thoughts about that one.
When it came out, I had, I think on Twitter, posted a little bit of math about this, the difference between it and Go for the Throat, mm-hmm. which costs the same and can't target artifact creatures. So in this case, you can't hit an outlaw versus Go for the Throat, which can't hit an artifact creature. Just looking at some EDH rec stats, Shoot the Sheriff does remove 24 of the top 25 most popular commanders and 24 of the top 25 most popular creatures. With changelings counted into this, there are 859 creatures Shoot the Sheriff won't hit. Go for the Throat also hits 24 of 25 commanders, only 23 of 25 creatures, and there are 994 artifact creatures that it won't hit. So Shoot the Sheriff, probably slightly better just in terms of available targets for it, But that's just like if you're not digging down into the numbers. And I think you did a little bit of that, Joey, to look at just which creatures and stuff it does and doesn't hit.
I saw, like, you know, when I did a Scryfall search for just like is outlaw, I got 1,002 outlaw creatures as a result versus like,
right.
You know, I searched up like artifact creature, I got 1,073. But like the more important question is like, what types of creatures do you want the ability to remove, and like which things are going to be, you know, how will it feel bad not being able to target stuff? And honestly, the stuff that like the most popular creatures that are of the outlaw types, like, you know, assassins and rogues and stuff like that, like, is the most popular stuff is like Dockside, Dockside Extortionist, or right, Douthi Voidwalker, right. Which like Dockside's already gotten its benefit, and Douthi Voidwalker will just sacrifice itself in response. Like, it's kind of those things, and I'm like, well, if I'm not hitting those, I feel okay. Versus like not being able to target an Academy Manufacturer or a Mere Battlesphere with Go for the Throat. Those actually do feel a little bit tougher for me. And that's interesting just because Go for the Throat is in like 130,000 decks, 7% of decks that are able to play it. And so to my estimation, this might be a little bit better of a removal spell. But with that said, I don't know if I'm still going to play it because I like stuff like Bitter Triumph and Infernal Grasp instead already. So just kind of interesting math that I'm not sure if it's actually important math.
Yeah, well, it's funny we're talking this much about a card that I don't think either of us will probably play. In part because Community talked about it a lot too. But yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat with you, Joey. I'm like, I think it's probably better than Go for the Throat, but I'm probably not running it anyway in Mono Black, even where I have Defile and Deadly Relic and Infernal Grasp and Baleful Mastery. And I just don't know if it's quite good enough to break in. And that's before we get into other color combinations that have access to other removal spells as well. So it's very interesting. And, you know, if you're on a budget or something, and maybe it makes sense. Probably not quite good enough, but it's a very, very good spell.
I mean, I'm surprised you both haven't talked about one card that, Dana, I'm sure you've at least like talked about, looked at, probably bought 4 or 5 copies because you can put a bunch of blue decks, but Seize the Secrets is another very Dana-esque card. It's just another spin on Divination where it's 2 and a blue to draw 2 cards, but it costs 1 less to cast if you've committed a crime this turn. And I know this all kind of comes down to how easy is it going to be to commit crimes in Magic the Gathering, not in real life, please. But yeah, just being able to draw 2 cards for 2 mana effectively, that's got Dana written all over it. So I'm curious if you've even given a look to that card, because we've seen a lot of spins on this type of card over the past few sets.
Yeah, it's one of those cards, like, I love Chart of Course, I love me some Winged Words. I just don't happen to have any decks where I feel like I can trigger this as consistently as I would want. But if I do find myself with one of those decks where, like, oh, the commander is doing a thing that's going to be committing a crime frequently, so therefore I can almost always cast it for 2, absolutely. Then it becomes Night's Whisper without costing me any life.
Yeah, those are interesting. I feel like some of the most easy enablers of committing crimes is stuff like Relic of Progenitus. It's just like, tap, please exile a card from target player's graveyard.
Yeah, there you go.
That will actually kind of get them. So I think it's probably one of those, unlike the other draw spells that Dana is famous for. It does require a little bit more effort, which is why it's probably like I'm not sure. Like, committing a crime can actually be like a little bit tough. It does sometimes mean a card, but like if you've got a lot of those things that are just like, here's a nice touch, little activated ability, then that can probably be a little bit easier for you. Matt, I'm just happy to see that you're talking about commons though.
And blue cards.
I know,
commons,
right?
And blue cards. It's, I mean, I'm turning a corner. Thunder Junctions is doing something for me, but we named the supplemental set with Big Score. We named the main set. We haven't even gotten to talk about the pre-cons either, right. Which also happened to be just absolutely juiced. And there's a ton of just powerful new cards. I think the only concern I have, and maybe feedback about this, is the pre-cons are so wordy and there's so many new cards. It's so hard for new players, I think, at this point to get into Commander, especially with just buying a pre-con these days, because they're getting so complex.
Well, I'll actually say I've gotten the chance to play with these pre-cons. You know, I was on a Commander at Home episode with Olivia Gobert-Hicks and Brian Kibler, and that was a whole lot of fun. But I will actually say the pre-cons for Thunder Junction were kind of a lower note for me. I didn't enjoy them as much as I've enjoyed a lot of previous pre-cons. I think maybe they were just hyper-specific or something, but it was kind of a strange environment, and there weren't as many things that stuck out to me from those pre-cons as I've like seen from other pre-con environments.
Yeah.
So like Thunder Junction is certainly an interesting set. I'm enjoying stuff from like the set proper, but not necessarily from the pre-con. So that's just the thing I wanted to quickly throw out.
Yeah. I mean, you got to play with Heartless Conscription, and that card, I mean, just looking at it seems absolutely bonkers in the world of very expensive board wipes.
Oh yeah, that's the board wipe that like exiles all the stuff, but then you can cast all those creatures later. Like all those things are now belong to me. A very gaunty type of board wipe there.
But remember Goblin Electromancer when that was like a card you could play and it'd be fine, and we just got a better version with Thunderclap Drake? It's a bunch of little things like that that just get me. Like there's a bunch of individually powerful cards in the pre-cons, but I agree with your assessment that like they may not be the best out of the box, and you kind of need to tailor them a little bit more than maybe pre-cons that we've seen in a few years past.
They definitely looked like they didn't match up together particularly well. I think might be one of the issues also.
I mean, before we talk about too much, because we've got a lot more to go that's come out in 2024, I think we need to take a quick break. We probably need to challenge some stats, and then we can get into more because, man, there's a lot more to talk about. Let's be real.
Too true, too true. We've got a lot of other stuff to cover, including some other sets. We can't just talk about the Contra Western set this whole show. But yes, we've got to challenge some stats for sure. So we'll be right back after this quick break.
For the past 30 years, Care Heating and Cooling put you first. You are the reason they are open 7 days a week. You are why they make it easy to schedule service at careheatingandcooling.com. Concern for your safety is why they check every gas furnace for carbon monoxide. It's because of you that their technicians are paid to fix your furnace and air conditioner, not sell you a new one. And if you do need a new furnace, their team will make sure you get exactly what you need at a cost that fits your budget. Care Heating and Cooling is committed to doing business right. Call them at 1-800-COOLING. When you need a company you can trust.
I think I'm going to start us off this week. I want to talk about Mirko, Obsessive Theorist from the Murders at Karlov Manor set, a 3-mana 1/3 vampire detective with flying and vigilance. Whenever you surveil, it gets a +1 counter, and at the beginning of your end step, you may return target creature card with power less than Mirko's from your graveyard to the battlefield with a finality counter on it, which means if it would die, you instead exile it. So this is, you know, a pretty interesting, you know, little Dimir commander here, trying to get its power up big enough to make sure that you actually can revive meaningful creatures is definitely the hurdle. But I'm not interested in reviving a whole bunch of those. I think this is such a cool commander for like clones. And we do see that like Spark Double is showing up in a really good chunk of Mirko lists already, but that just makes me want to play even more of them because clones in the graveyard have zero power. So why is Clever Impersonator only showing up in like less than a quarter of Mirko lists? Because you can choose that one as the thing to revive. It's got zero power. Mirko's already got one power. And then you can have Clever Impersonator enter as a copy of any non-land permanent on the battlefield. So you're not just reviving creatures, you're reviving someone else's best enchantment, for example. Or like, you can get back an Auton Soldier, which is really, if you're playing Spark Double, you might want to do this too, because Auton Soldier will enter as a copy of any creature on the battlefield, except it won't be legendary, it will be an artifact in addition, and it will have Myriad, so you can get even more copies of them. If you're playing Mirko, seriously give these a look. They're showing up in fewer than a quarter of Mirko lists, but like reviving clones that can become huge stuff, that's a great way to cheat around the necessities of trying to get Mirko to have a whole bunch of power. I think those are really, really worth a look. So try them out if you're playing Mirko.
Well, my challenge this week is for a green win condition, and the card is Overwhelming Encounter. A 3 double green for a sorcery, and it says creatures you control gain vigilance and trample until end of turn, and then you roll a d20. If you hit 1 through 9, creatures you control get +2/+2 to end of turn. If you hit 10 to 19, you put 2+1 counters on each creature you control. And if you hit a 20, you put 4+1 counters on each creature you control. Green decks oftentimes want to win in the combat step by just turning stuff sideways with all the bodies they have in play. And to buff that up, they oftentimes are using things like Crater Hoof Behemoth or Pathbreaker Ibex or Overwhelming Stampede. Except those are all pretty expensive cards that not everyone has access to. Overwhelming Encounter is 15 cents, and it has the advantage of giving your creatures vigilance as well, and half the time it's going to leave the buff on the creatures to stick around as blockers if you can't finish everybody off. This is a card I originally ran strictly as a budget card in a budget deck that I didn't have any other options. And I've really started to like it as just a card to run, even if you're not necessarily on a real tight budget, for the reasons I mentioned, giving those creatures vigilance, oftentimes leaving the buff on them until next turn. If you have a perfect like green deck with all of the expensive overrun options, you probably don't quite need it. But if you don't, it's the best of the budget options, and I think it definitely should be in more than 6,000 decks.
Dana, can I yes and your challenge here? I also, this was another uncommon that stood out to me from Thunder Junction was Full Steam Ahead, the five mana green sorcery that gives your stuff +2/+2, trample, and they can't be blocked by more than one creature. Like, you know, there are a lot of big classic, huge overrun type of effects, but like these other ones, these uncommon ones, they're subtly really, really powerful, and they give you a lot of cool abilities to either keep your defenses up or find extra neat ways to push damage through. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I gotta say, I agree with you a lot. These are really, like, if you see them, you're probably still just as dead. Like,
right, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, everyone knows Crater Hoop's probably going to kill the table, but, like, in many cases, these are going to do the same exact thing for a fraction of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
So my card comes from a listener who went to our Discord server, and which you can join at patreon.com/edhrecast. And Mojay said, I know that there are only 500 Yuma decks out there so far, but I think Key to the City is a fantastic ad for Yuma decks. It's currently not showing up on any of them on EDH Rec, but it lets you discard a land to make Yuma unblockable, which then lets you sack a land to draw a card, replacing what you discarded and potentially allowing you to create two plant warriors to be created as well. So there's a lot of words there, and Yuma is a brand new commander, but Yuma is 5 in Naya colors for a 6/6 human ranger that says the spell costs 1 less to cast for each land card in your graveyard, and then whenever Yuma, Proud Protector, enters the battlefield or attacks, you may sacrifice a land, and if you do, draw a card, and whenever a desert is put into your graveyard from anywhere, you create a 4/2 green plant warrior creature token with reach. So right there, that's pretty great. And then Key to the City is 2 mana for an artifact that lets you tap and discard a card to have up to 1 target creature that can't be blocked this turn. And whenever Key to the City becomes untapped, you may pay 2 mana, and if you do, draw a card. So basically, you're able to tap it, discard a card, and discard a desert, which will then trigger Yuma. And then also when it becomes untapped, you can pay that 2 mana, draw a card, and you're just able to let Yuma go in haphazardly, and then thus creating a whole army of plant tokens. Now, Yuma's a 6/6, already pretty big, and so you don't have to worry too much about unblockable, but it does mean that there's a way to get through. You're going to be dealing combat damage. And again, too, like Mojay pointed out, you're getting the engine online. You're creating a bunch of tokens. You're putting deserts into your graveyard from anywhere because you're discarding them for free. I think it's just a nice synergy. It's a nice utility piece for Yuma decks. Yuma is a fairly popular commander, it turns out. So I would expect to see maybe some more cards fleshed out that are going to feed into being able to discard deserts at any given time. There's a lot of fun synergies you can play with surprise blockers. So yeah, I think this is a good option if you are looking for one of those utility type cards in your Yuma Proud Protector decks.
I do like this a lot. Ways to sneaky ways to get those things into your graveyard. It matters a lot. As a person who really cares a whole lot about the graveyard, I'm way into this. And the fact that Yuma triggers whenever your deserts hit the graveyard from anywhere is a really important line of text to take advantage of. So this is really sweet. Thank you so much for the challenge, Mojay. Okay, guys, so we've talked a lot about this Western set, but now we got to go on and talk about it. Where the accent just came out of nowhere. I'm sorry. Matt, you liked Fallout this year. a lot.
Well,
I think.
You said we aren't talking about the what? You said we aren't talking about the Western set no more. And Fallout, very much, if you've seen the show, is set in the West.
Is it? Okay. I don't. Matt, I've also never played a Fallout game.
there's a lot of running and gunning in Fallout, as it were. And there's cards all about running and gunning. One of our preview cards, Grim Reaper Sprint, that card is bonkers. This is probably the most powerful card in the set. And we got to preview it, which makes me very biased, I know. But this card is absolutely wild, and I'm surprised so many people aren't playing this, because it's so powerful.
I am surprised, too. It's like the 36th most popular card from the Fallout set, and like that's weird to me. It's weird, because it is really, yeah. It's a 5-mana red enchantment, but it costs 3 less to cast if a creature has died this turn. You enchant a creature, it gets +2/+2 in haste, but also, like, when it enters, it's another combat. You get another combat, so, like, I'm like, what's not clicking? This card's really good. Why is it so low on the list? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Extra combats for 2 mana, and it's repeatable. So if you have ways to bounce it back to your hand, which there's so many different ways and so many different colors these days. I think Grim Reaper Sprint is just such a powerful, powerful card. And again, I know I'm biased because we got to preview this card, but still, it's so good.
I think you're biased because you love to attack step. Like, that card's too, good if you attack
step. There's a lot of reasons to like this card is what we're saying.
Bias aside, this is, I think, one of my favorite cards from the set for sure. It wins games, and like the right deck, it's just going to win you games.
Well, what else stands out to you, Dana?
I liked Atomize quite a bit. You know, it's one of those cards, green, black, and two colorless, destroy target non-land permanent, and then you proliferate. It's probably slightly too expensive as a removal spell if you're not doing something with like plus one counters or planeswalkers or something that you do want to proliferate. But if you are, it's like that's a no-brainer then at that point. Like, you will gladly slightly overpay to remove any permanent for the ability to throw extra counters on all your stuff or throw more poison on everybody else or buff your planeswalkers or whatever it is. Like, in the deck that does that thing, easy run, and it feels really, really strong. Having ran it in two decks already.
Yeah, I love it for poison decks.
Yeah. Perfect example.
Yeah, poison, super friends. There's always going to be a lot of counters that you want to proliferate.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I got to be honest. The stuff that actually stood out to me most from the Fallout cards was like they completed the onslaught cycle of filter lands, which I just call the signet lands now, like Viridescent Bog, Overflowing Basin, things like that. I've wanted that cycle to be complete for a while because we only ever had like the Skycloud Expanse versions of them, the allied colors, and now we have enemy color versions. So like I was truly the most happy to see those from the Fallout set, which is maybe a little bit basic of me, but I was just like, yay, they finally completed the cycle.
Yeah, I mean, they just did a really good job and just knocked it out of the park through and through, I think, with this set. I whether it was finishing cycles like you said, and the way that just the flavor was translated, I'm a big fan of the Parks cards that they printed. Cards like Idolized is such a just perfect execution of what Idolized does in the game and then also what it does in Magic as well. And just, I played so much Fallout 4, it's not even funny. Just any Bethesda games. And so just the flavor that translated onto the cards, there's so much here to like.
Codsworth, Handy Helper.
Oh, yeah.
If you are playing any kind of equipment deck, it does like six different things you want that equipment deck to be doing. You know, for two and a white, it's a 2/3 body. It's going to protect your commanders by giving them ward two. It's going to tap for two white mana that you can use for aura or equipment spell. So it's a mana dork that lets you cast the stuff. You can tap it to attach an aura or equipment you control to a creature you control. So you can cheat some cost around a little bit if you need to move things from one place to another. But like just the ability to give your commanders ward and be a mana dork, that alone is probably worth in almost any aura equipment deck. And a lot of times in those decks, people are doing things that like count the number of artifacts you have. And it's an artifact to also add to that count. So it's all of the things in that kind of deck.
Yeah, Codsworth just does, like you said, Dana, does like six things that you want in that given deck. I love Codsworth. It has overperformed for me so far in my decks I have it into. It's great.
And on top of that, every time I cast Codsworth, I will hear Matt Berry's voice now, which is the best thing you could actually possibly have on a card.
But why is Codsworth talking to Nadja?
Right.
Oh, no. It's more references that I don't understand. I'm sorry, internet. This
we're crossing streams. It's okay.
I'm just trying to see how many more things can I tell Matt that like I haven't played or I don't know. I haven't seen stuff like that. And unfortunately, Fallout is one of those things.
That's fine.
Oh, man. I do have to shout out, though, real quick. It's fun that the set code for this, you know, like Murders at Markov Manor, Murders at Karlov Manor. Dang it. I hate that name. Murders at Karlov Manor. The set code was MKM and this one was PIP. PIP. I'm just like, listen, I haven't played Fallout, but even I know that's really funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's just, I think that Fallout might be one of my favorite sets, probably going back to the Lord of the Rings set, which was probably my favorite set of all time. Just, they did so many just little things right, I think, too. Power Fist is just a fun execution of what Power Fists do in the game. And just, yeah, it was executed really well. There's a ton of flavor. There's a ton of legends from whatever game that you played that was in Fallout. You have a fun legendary creature to build around too. Just this one just knocked it out of the park for me. Just, I know there are nitpicks that people had, but I'm all on board with what they did with Fallout.
I think that's a really great way to summarize it, actually, Matt. Like, we're seeing the cards that had the like most penetration into the EDH ecosystem were a lot of the cards with rad counters associated with them. So people were doing a lot of graveyard stuff, a lot of mill or self-mill. But like, there are so many. There are 52 legendary creatures from the Fallout set. So there's a lot of stuff that you can do, a lot of different things to tinker around with. And so, yeah, maybe don't sleep on too many of them, because like with that many designs, like, goodness, there's going to be some really cool stuff that people have missed and that people just won't know a whole lot about, because every set is coming out with so many legends. But 52, that's a lot. There's a lot of legendary creatures to look through to maybe find some inspiration for new decks as well. Mm-hmm. With that said, though, we had one other set this year, and that was the set I misnamed, the set that everyone has misnamed, Murders at Karlov Manor. How were we feeling about that one? You know, it came out in February earlier this year. What were the standouts from that one, do you guys think?
I mean, I think easy answer is the fetchable dual land cycle. That just jumps out to everybody, but it's also, you know, it's some of the most played cards in the set so far. For example, Undercity Sewers, Island and a Swamp, so you can fetch it with your fetch lands, enters the battlefield tapped, and then when they enter the battlefield, they surveil once, you look at the top card, and either you scry it to the top of your library or into the graveyard. So, Joey, you're probably on board with those.
So
but those
much.
Just got adopted so stinking fast. Like, every single one of them is towards the top of the set when it comes to most played cards.
Absolutely. These cards have changed the way that I use fetch lands. Like, just, all right, cool, free card in my graveyard. I don't even necessarily think that these were like healthy for my play patterns, if I'm being honest. These are very good.
So the note I will throw about these out there is as someone who doesn't really play stuff out of his graveyard, they are just a marginal upgrade over the cycling lands. And given the fact that they're seeing so much standard play and the price of them is, you know, pretty much $10 plus for all of them, for me, they haven't felt worth the upgrade over something else I would be running in that slot. But that, I think, is a lot of a me thing where I don't have any decks where I want to be putting stuff in the graveyard at all. So it winds up being, so we're looking at a combination of my playstyle makes them kind of a marginal upgrade, and the cost has made me like, not, if I didn't crack them in a pack, I'm not worried about them for now.
I agree on the cost. They weren't all that expensive at first, which is when I got mine, and then they like doubled and then nearly tripled in price. I was like, yeah. Okay, yeah, I'm glad I got these when I did. So that makes a whole lot of sense. Totally understand that. But like, these are fetchable temples.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you can like Farseek into effectively a scry. And I'm like, oh, I didn't need it. And even if you're not going to use the graveyard, just like, I'm glad I didn't draw that card is a great effect to have in a land.
Yeah.
I already really like temples in two color decks, so I love these, but they also have land types that you can fetch. So like, yeah. Those are a standout, and I'm not even, I said I don't think they're healthy for my play patterns. I think that like maybe this is like a 1-3-5 situation, not like quite onto a 5, but I'm just like, you know, they probably could have just done the surveil and not needed the land types, and they still would have been good.
Yeah, I mean, people have seen how powerful the temples are, and just giving these basic land types, you can argue if it's healthy for the game, but yeah, being able to fetch these in response and do all sorts of different things, that there's a lot of strategy that goes into playing these, and whole can of worms.
Very much, yeah. Speaking of some standout cards from this set, though, like, y'all mentioned that I use the graveyard. A card that mentions graveyard stuff that stood out to me from this set was the Mythic Vein Ripper. Just a new and improved big blood artist for 6 mana, 6/5. It's a vampire, it's an assassin, it flies, so it hit hard, but it also has ward, sacrifice a creature. So, like, if you're going to hit it, you have to sacrifice a thing, which for some folks won't even necessarily be the biggest cost in the world. But it says whenever a creature dies, target opponent loses 2 life and you gain 2 life. That counts itself. Like, if you destroy it, I'm probably draining 4 life from somebody. But also, like, if it is around to see a little bit of battle or even a board wipe, like, how can anyone cast a board wipe when this thing is in play? This can deal a whole lot of damage. So that, of course, really caters to my predilections with aristocrat style decks. So like, big blood artist, it got right into my decks, and I'm not surprised to see the price tag that this one commands, because it's very, very impressive.
And the price tag also is predicated on the fact that it showed up in a Pro Tour winning deck in 60 card formats, but also the ward isn't insignificant. I saw this happen both in 60 card formats, but also in a commander game with Vein Ripper. So the way that ward works, it's a triggered ability, so it's not part of the cost. So you target Vein Ripper, ward goes on the stack, do you want to sacrifice a creature or not? Well, the person only had one creature in play.
Oh no.
And so in response to the ward trigger, they killed the one creature they had in play, so they couldn't pay the ward cost. And
that's evil.
It makes it so hard to get rid of. There's a lot of play behind Vein Ripper. It's a absolutely powerful card. You are not lying there though.
It sounds like this is not one that you really care for, because you're just like, Joey's going to do stuff with this, and I just want to have my...
I'm giving Joey terrible ideas, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, speaking of powerful cards, Trouble in Pairs. We won't go into the absolute saga that is the artwork story behind it.
But Trouble in Plagiarism, card, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. But like, as a card, you know, 2/2 white for an enchantment. Whenever an opponent attacks you with 2 or more creatures, draws their second card each turn or casts their second spell each turn, you draw a card. So like, that's almost always just going to draw you a card every spin around the table, if not multiples. And that's, it has the unnecessary text, if opponent will begin an extra turn, that player skips that turn instead. And that's just, that doesn't need to be on there to make it one of the strongest white cards of the year. If not one of the strongest cards of the year in Commander, for sure.
Yeah.
And the price reflects that. It is an expensive card. It's closing down to $30 right now.
Yeah, one of the strongest cards, just full stop. You know how a few years ago we were promised powerful white cards in certain sets? This be yeah. Powerful white cards. I think this is absolutely one of those things. And again, 1/3/5 problem, where this card is just absolutely catapulting white into just like, it's got some very, very powerful effects.
Yeah, this one's the truth. Like, we've seen a whole lot of like attempts at trying to like give this one's like, ooh, you might have even gone a little overstep the bounds, actually.
I think Wedding Ring was a good step towards this, but Trouble in Pairs just absolutely, like, this is the type of effect that like white wanted for so long, and I'm glad they're finally, and the color pie team is finally comfortable giving these effects to white.
And it's one of those things, like, even if the person plays around it, there are some of these effects where, like, if someone finds a way to play around it, it feels bad. What they have to do to successfully play around this consistently still feels pretty good. Like, it is limiting your opponent so much to not do the things that would trigger them that you tend to feel okay with that in a way that sometimes you don't with other attempts at this in white.
Right, right. I think I will be picking up my copy whenever they reprint it, both for price and because of the art. And actually, another like 4-mana white card that does stand out to me from the set too comes from the Commander Precons. I've really been enjoying Unexplained Absence. This is the 4-mana instant. For each player, you exile up to 1 target non-land permanent that they control. For each permanent exiled this way, its controller cloaks the top card of their library, so they get a 2/2 thing. I mean, I already love Grasp of Fate because, you know, I can hit something for each person if I want to, but Grasp of Fate is sorcery speed and it's a removable enchantment. I still really like it. I think it's a great card. And this is for 1 more mana, but it doesn't cost 2 white pips. It's at instant speed and it forever gets rid of the thing. Yeah, they get a 2/2, but like, I already play plenty of Reality Shift. I know that manifesting the top card of an opponent's library isn't really a big deal. And if I can do that for everybody and even get rid of one of my own things, if I need like an emergency blocker, for example, there's a lot of play to this, and I wish it was seeing a little bit more play than it currently does. It's only in like 3,600 decks so far. This one impresses me a lot. If you like Grasp of Fate, I think you should try out this one too.
Yeah, it's one of those cards that's really good on its own, and then occasionally you'll be able to tell a story about how somebody had their approach to Second Sun floating to the top of their library, and you were holding this in hand just in time so you could hit it and cloak it before they could draw it, or you stopped a Mystical Tutor someone cast to go get a win condition or something.
Sure. Like,
it's a great card on its own, and it has enough weird fringe uses that will make for really good stories.
Well, I think one card too that it doesn't have any weird fringe uses, it's just like generically extremely powerful. In my mind, it's probably one of the most powerful charms we've gotten, but Archdruid's Charm, that card is overperformed in so many different ways. Triple green.
Has it? Okay.
So it's hard to cast, triple green, but choose one and you get 3 options. Search your library for a creature or a land card, reveal it, put it on the battlefield, tapped if it's a land card, otherwise put it into your hand, then shuffle. So grabbing any land and putting it onto the battlefield, already pretty powerful at instant speed, no less. You can also put a +1/+1 counter on a creature you control. Then it deals damage equal to its power to target creature you don't control. So able to have a pseudo fight ability and then exile target artifact or enchantment. I have this in my Legolas Master Archer deck. This card is wild. I absolutely love it. And again, triple green, so it's cost prohibitive. It's going to be kind of hard to pull it off in a 3-color deck for sure, maybe even a 2-color deck. But man, every time I've cast this, it's been relevant. It's been great. This card just does so many things that I want to do in that Legolas deck.
It does so many things, and they are so different from one another that there's always a situation where one of them is useful. Like, sometimes you get these modal effects, and you're like, well, I don't know how often I'm going to find myself in a position where like, or in a deck where they are all viable options. These are all really viable options in a bunch of situations. And not only wildly different situation, but like you can find yourself, okay, I'm going to leave three green mana up and I will use the tutor at the end of, you know, before my turn. But you might find yourself using any of those modes. Like very often you're like, you specifically know what mode you're going to use. In this case, any opportunity could present itself to make fantastic use of this.
Yeah, there's never a dead draw when it's Arcturus Charm.
Yeah.
There's always something to do.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Even when like abilities on charms are a little far flung, sometimes that makes them even better as a result of that.
Yeah.
If they're too similar, then you're just like, no, I really like those niche cases on charms actually can have a whole bunch of stuff. But like even just finding any land is it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. I do like the triple green restriction a lot. I love seeing that on cards. Like that's a fun design constraint to see them leaning into.
Agree.
I really do think that Boros probably like made out the best from MKM, if I'm honest. Like War Leader's Call, Take the Bait. Here's an anthem that also impact trammers your opponents, or here's like a new version of Illusionist Gambit. Like, you were attacking me? No, you are attacking, but it's going to be somebody else. Those are cool. Or like even the new Demand Answers, which is a new and improved version of Red's like rummage draw. It's like, two mana instant. I have to discard a card to draw two cards, but I could also just sacrifice an artifact to draw two cards. Like those little improvements, I think Boros made out really, really well in MKM.
Yeah, Demand Answers is the most played card in the set. Over 21,000 decks so far, which is, it's over 1,000 decks, more than Arcturus Charm even. There's a reason. Demand Answers is extremely powerful, especially when you consider a lot of the draw effects that Red's been getting lately is impulse draw, so you're only able to have access to it till the end of your turn, maybe the end of your next turn. Demand Answers being able to just get you two draws, very, very powerful at instant speed, no less. I totally get why Demand Answers is in such high demand, and I did mean to pun that.
It's in such high demand, Answers, well done. And if I'm being honest, I think much of my impression of the year so far, like when I ask, okay, how is 2024 stacking up? I think Demand Answers is actually kind of a good encapsulation of how I'm feeling about 2024 so far. I don't mean
you're demanding answers.
No. I mean, in terms of like what I am seeing and like what intrigues me most, what actually catches my attention the most from the sets we've had so far this year are these cards that have those little improvements. Mm-hmm. You know, the Demand Answers type of thing where it's like, okay, cool. It's not just discard a card. I also now have this other extra option. Or the War Leader's call isn't just a, you know, an anthem effect. It also has this extra little spice tacked onto it. It's been a year of subtle improvements for me as opposed to big bombastic things, I guess, is like kind of my impression of the year so far. So there's nothing that's like blown me away, but I'm seeing little stuff that moves in a direction that I'm enjoying. And that's kind of where I'm at. But I don't think that you guys share my perspective there. Like, Matt, you got Fallout this year, so I think you're just like, no, the big bombastic, give me everything. But I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about how you're evaluating.
I mean, I very much appreciated just the flavor. And like there are a bunch of, like you said, incremental improvements, quality of life type of things. But then I look at cards like Vaultborn Tyrant, and then I'm like, no, there were leaps forward.
Okay.
There were absolutely like I said, the 1-3-5 problem. I know I've said that a few times, but like there are definitely some massive jumps forward with like the overall power of cards, and not just individual cards, but just sets. The overall power that any given set is injecting into the format. I think very much it's little improvements here and there, but when you take the big picture into account, the format as a whole is getting kind of launched forward with these past few sets.
I liked these sets and enjoyed them. At the same time, I feel a little bit like I'm waiting to get my first Magic set of the year.
Yeah,
I feel like we've gotten kind of pseudo Universe Beyond sets for the most part. In Markov Manor and Thunder Junction, just a lot of like Magic characters wearing hats, and that's not a bad thing really, but it just feels like it's not quite the paper boomer Magic I'm anticipating or looking forward to. I guess Bloomburrow feels like it will be back to that, despite it just being a bunch of small fuzzy animals. But like for me, that feels a little bit more like the Magic aesthetic I'm looking for than the sets we've gotten. That's like I said, that doesn't bother me or anything. It just feels like I'm still waiting for the first proper Magic set of 2024.
Can I honestly, like, I made a note too. It's just like, honestly, I feel like I'm waiting for Bloomborough still. Like, I think that is.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm kind of still holding my breath.
I don't know why that is, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't either. But it does feel like I'm still kind of like holding my breath for this year. I'm not like mad about the year, not by any means. And there have been some cards that, this impresses me. And like, oh, that's nice to see. But like, for example, when I was on the Commander at Home show, we played with the OTJ precons. And Olivia and I both got to talking about how, like, the most impactful cards that we're seeing in these games are, like, Mizzix's Mastery and Scoot Swarm. Like, cards that already pre-existed rather than, like, the new stuff really standing out and taking a whole lot of focus. And, like, you know, I don't want brand new cards to always be super overpowered or anything, but, like, that was just an interesting observation that we both independently made. I'm not feeling, like, huge true zeal necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, if it comes around to the end of the year, Mark Rosewater's like stated design article, I think they're probably really going to hit on like Karlov Manor as being a particularly low point. If I'm being honest, there have been some mythics that I enjoyed from it, but like the flavor of the set was not it for me. The storytelling of the set, I'm just like, they reversed how you do a detective story. Like, they're like, you gotta care about like who was murdered and why. And I'm just, that's not how a cozy detective murder mystery works. You gotta care about the detective, and they're all new suspects that we've never seen before. Like, why was this on Ravnica? Like, I still have those questions lingering, which I know it's like a meme at this point, but like, flavorfully, it didn't feel like Ravnica. Like, there were those things that missed. And even then, some of the cards, like, I built an Izoni deck, and I've just turned it into an Honest Rutstein deck instead. Which, Honest Rutstein, he's the truth. You should check that out. That commander's very, very good. But yeah, it's just a lot of like subtle impressions is my feeling of the year so far. And I can't wait until later in the year to see what else we're going to get.
Yeah, I think flavor-wise, I share your kind of, I don't know, like uneasy feeling about how things have been going. To me, like, Thunder Junction didn't really feel like a Magic set. And I think,
really,
just in general, maybe my approach has been Magic the Gathering is a game system that's going to translate all these different things versus, sure, a traditional Magic set as we know it. Maybe that's kind of dead these days. It's not like the high fantasy,
yeah,
look anymore. And I think that's kind of been, there have been here and there little like hints that was coming. But that's maybe the best way that like I personally have been able to kind of handle the tonal shift of Magic the Gathering sets, where we have, you know, Magic the Hattening, whether it's a fedora or a cowboy hat.
Excuse me, it's called a deer stalker, Matt. How could you?
Are you sure? Because I'm pretty
Fedora's
sure.
Fedora's a new Capenna.
even there, yeah.
But no, I understand it. And like, there are, again, like, I was so happy to see your zeal with Fallout. That made me happy to see, because you love that, and you love seeing the way it translated.
So good.
Even if it didn't quite get for me. And so like, I'm looking forward to the sets that I know are going to have that impact. It just hasn't quite happened yet in the first third of the year. I'm not necessarily mad about that though. And like the fact that we're not getting another set until June, I'm like, cool, a nice breather. I've enjoyed a little bit of like mental time off from this. I'm still enjoying the stuff and watching people connect with it in the way that I'm not necessarily. Beautiful. Love to see that. But I am still just like, I'm holding my breath and I'm looking forward to some stuff in the future is ultimately my biggest first impression of the year.
Yeah, I definitely think like just because the aesthetic of Magic the Hattening the last couple sets didn't really work for me, doesn't mean it's bad, right? Like,
yeah,
it just didn't work for me, and like, I acknowledge that it's just not my thing, and I'm looking forward to something that feels like more what I want. But I also don't feel comfortable, like, if I thought it was a huge misstep, I would say so, and it doesn't feel like a misstep. It just feels like a thing,
yeah,
that doesn't connect with me personally, and if it connects with somebody else out there, that's fantastic. It's not entirely my jam, and I'm looking forward to something a little more traditional coming up.
Yeah, we're still getting the cards to play with, and
yeah,
if the flavor happens to hit for people that are just getting into the game, I think one big thing to remember is the game's still growing faster than it ever has before, whether it's through Universes Beyond sets, whether it's through cards or sets like Karlov Manor. Like, it's still bringing people into the game. It's giving them these cool and fun settings that they're attaching themselves to, and I mean, we still get the cards that we get to play with. The flavor for me maybe isn't the selling point anymore, and that's fine. Just, I'm still enjoying these new sets, and I'm still enjoying getting to beat people down with like an idolized Samwise Gamgee, and that's just great for me.
Oh no, I can't wait to see that in our next game. That'll be great. Yeah, Matt, I think that's a nice way to end on it for sure. And listeners, we absolutely want to hear what you think of 2024 so far. Like, what is your favorite set? Or is your favorite set still upcoming with the stuff that we know is going to happen later in this year? How are you feeling? Are you impressed by the subtle improvements in like uncommons and stuff like that, or are you like, oh, here are these bombastic mythics that I'm just so over the moon about? It's a really great thing to see. And Matt, as you said, this game is growing and growing fast for a lot of these reasons for sure. So it is. I'm curious to see what lies in the future, including for my future, a ticket to the Dune 2 movie, which I need to see. I will do it before this episode comes out, I promise.
Joe, I'm glad you're finally doing it, so good for you.
And with that, we're going to call this episode to a close. If our listeners would like to get in touch with us, where can they find you? Matt, where can they find... How dare you? Where are you at online, man?
Well, you could have found me like a month ago watching Dune in theaters, like a true patriot. But anyways, you can also find me on pretty much any social media platform at Mathimus55. It's the same everywhere. MathimuS55. And don't forget, I'm also going to be rocking any like Universe Beyond Dune decks in Ultimate Guard Boulders, because we are proud members of Team Ultimate Guard. So if you also would like to get your hands on the best deck building accessories to protect your cards, check out Team Ultimate Guard.
And Dana, how about you?
Wow, nice. You can find me online at Dana Roach. I'm writing articles for EDH Rec and Commander's Herald, and you can find all of us together at patreon.com/EDHRecCast.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me everywhere online at Joseph M. Schultz, most likely being a fool on like Instagram or something like that. And you can find the cast at EDH RecCast online. Plus, if you got a question for us, you can contact us at edhreccast@gmail.com. Our thanks go out once again to Chase for their fantastic work in the post-production of the show. You can find them online at Mana Curves. And listeners, will be back at you next week with more data and insights. But until then, remember, EDH wreck your deck before you wreck your deck.